Blog Talk Radio.
Either you run the day, or the day runs you.
You're listening to the Goldstein on Geld Show with financial expert Douglas Goldstein. This show is designed to give general information related to investing and finance. Neither Doug Goldstein, his guests, nor the radio station are rendering legal, tax, insurance, or specific financial advice. If you require such advice, contact a competent professional advisor. Before making any investment decisions based on what you heard during the show, please review the complete disclaimer located at www.goldsteinongeld.com. And now, here's your host, money maven Doug Goldstein.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Doug Goldstein, your host of the Goldstein on Geld Show. I just had an article recently I put in the Jerusalem Post, and it actually got a lot of response because, you know, I write this weekly piece in the Jerusalem Post. By the way, we post those at profileperspectives.com, which is kind of my regular blog. The piece was about increasing the income from your portfolio, and, you know, these days it's so difficult for people to get more income from their accounts because interest rates are so low. We often talk about the political side of this, which is simply, you know, maybe you remember if you were investing 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago that interest rates were much higher. It's true there was more inflation then too, although a lot of people argue that there's inflation now. But now interest rates are so low. How come? So one of the political arguments is simply that the government is keeping rates so low so that they can continue to borrow more and more money. The U.S. government literally borrows trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars and more every second. And when they borrow so much money, if interest rates were higher, the cost of borrowing would be unbelievably high for them. So the rates are kind of artificially kept down. But politics or not, that's not our business. What do we do as normal people and as financial advisors who are trying to help normal people to increase the yield on their portfolio? Well, that's what I wrote about. One of the things I wrote about was certain tools that people use, and I'll tell you about that in just 1 minute. Now let's hear from CPA Ron Zalbin with a tax tip on the Goldstein on Geld Show.
Hi, I'm Ron Zalbin, a U.S. and Israeli CPA with the accounting firm of Abulafia Avital and Sharensky, with offices in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. In today's segment, I'd like to remind you of some important deadline dates. For U.S. taxes, if you live in America, the due date for returns is April 15th, 2015 for the 2014 return. If you live overseas, the due date for the return is June 15th, 2015 for tax year 2014. If you live overseas, even though your due date is June 15th, if you owe any tax, interest starts accruing as of April 15th. June 30th is the deadline for FBARs. You can extend your return from June 15th to October 5th for 2014, so the first extended due date is October 15th. And there's an option to extend the return for another 2 months for 2014 to December 15th of 2015. As I said before, interest will start accruing as of April 15th. So even if you file by October or December, the interest will start accruing as of April 15th. The deadline for 2015 estimated tax payments. The first deadline is April 15th of 2015 for the first quarter. For the second quarter, June 15th of 2015. For the third quarter, September 15th of 2015. And for the fourth quarter payment, January 15th. Of 2016. For Israeli individual returns, if you are represented by an accounting firm, the first deadline is June 30th. The second deadline, if you're represented by an accounting firm, is the end of August. And the last and final deadline is the end of November. For corporations, for Israeli corporations, that is, the first deadline is July 31st. The second deadline is November 30th. And the last deadline is the following February. If you're a corporate shareholder in Israel, your due date is the same due date as your Israeli corporation. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to email me at ron@abulafia.co.il.
Thanks so much, CPA Ron Zalbin, for today's Goldstein on Geld Tax Tip. We spoke a moment ago about the low interest rate environment, and what do people do? Who are the people who are most hurt by this? Well, it's retirees, because people who were working their whole life saved money, and they thought, one day I'll put my money in the bank, I'll get interest payments, I'll live off the interest, and now they find if they put their money in the bank, they get 0% interest. Maybe if they're lucky, they'll get a little bit more than that, but it's certainly not enough to live off of, so you have to end up eating into principal. There are investment tools that are out there. Probably the most common thing that I talk to clients about is using bonds. Now, there are pros and cons to buying bonds. The pros are that you can get regular income. It's predictable. If you buy a bond and the company doesn't default or the government doesn't default, you know when you're going to get your money back. So that's a real benefit. The disadvantage is every time you invest your money in something that's going to pay you a little more income than you're getting in the bank, by definition, there's going to be more risk. So what's the risk with bonds? Of course, they could default. A company could go out of business, and then you could lose up to all of your money. They might just have financial problems and not be able to pay the interest. And of course, there are market forces in play. If you buy a bond and then later decide to sell it, the price could be lower than when you bought it, and you could actually end up losing money. So it's difficult to know exactly how you should be investing your money. In times of low interest rates, should you buy real estate? Should you buy stocks with high dividends? Whenever you're going to get involved in this, the critical thing is to make sure that you ask a lot about the risks. If someone tells you, oh, this is really safe and it pays a high interest rate, you've got to run away. I remember I was once speaking to a fellow who called me. He had an investment, and he wanted me as an investment advisor to sell it to my clients. So I asked him to explain it to me, and it was one of these types of things that sounded too good to be true. So I said to him, could you explain the risks to me so I could explain them to my clients? And he thought, and he looked like he was really trying to figure it out. He goes, well, I don't think there really are any risks. He goes, oh, well, of course there's the risk. Let's say there was a nuclear war. And I thought this guy was a nut. Who could say such things? If you are producing a financial product and you don't even understand the risks to explain to another professional, then you certainly shouldn't even be in the field. The point is, as an investor yourself, if you're looking to try and increase yield, sometimes taking risk is okay, depending on your goals and your financial plan and your tolerance for risk. I don't mind working with risk. I'm in that field. But you need to understand what the risk is. So we're going to be bringing on in just a minute a real risk player, someone who specializes in hedging risk, and then a man named Khalid Begas, and he'll be talking to us about that. And in the second half of the show, I'll be bringing on Chris Cogswell, a money manager, talking about a very, very special strategy that they use in their company.
Got a question for Doug that you'd like answered on the air? Go to GoldsteinOnGelt.com and click on the Send Listener Question button that's right in the middle of the page. Use your computer to record your question, and Doug will try to answer it in an upcoming show.
Okay, we are back. I'm very happy to have on the Goldstein on Gelt show Khalid Begas, who is a principal and financial risk management consultant with a very, very major company that lots of individual investors haven't heard of called Milliman. Khalid, a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Doug.
So before we dive into some of the detailed questions, tell us a little bit who Milliman is and what is the risk management business all about?
So Milliman is one of the world's largest financial risk management and actuarial advisory consulting firms. Most individual investors would not have heard about Milliman before, but most institutional players around the world would know who Milliman is. And so what we do mostly in my unit is provide financial risk management services to large financial institutions around the world. We've also expanded our business now to, through those large financial institutions, provide risk management of client portfolios directly to the underlying investors.
Okay, so that's in fact why you and I are here today, because the types of people who listen to the Goldstein on Gelt show are, they're people, they're not institutions, but many of them are concerned certainly about the volatility and the risks in the market. So what are the main risks that investors face in their portfolios today?
Well, if you think about investors and anyone who's investing, whether it's individual or institutional, they all have the same goals. People are investing for a purpose. And with individual investors, the purpose is largely to draw an income from those investments at some point in the future. So the risks that key risks as we see it that investors face in their portfolios is firstly, there's obviously a market risk that everyone is aware of, that there are fluctuations in the market, sometimes extreme fluctuations that would impact the income that investors could draw from those portfolios in the future. There's also a liquidity risk that investors face in the fact that the assets that they have at their portfolio at any point in time, they may not be able to sell those assets at a reasonable price to provide for the income that they need.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke about market risk and liquidity risk. The solution that we've always heard people talk about is try to look beyond the short term. And if you're a long-term investor, then all of those things kind of just flatten out over time. You don't remember the ups and downs. Do you think that's true?
Well, you know, if you think about the main way that people construct portfolios, it is sort of based on taking the long-term view. So people would, for example, look at equities and say, well, in the long run, this is the return, this is the volatility. For bonds, in the long run, this is the return, that's the volatility. And so if I put together a portfolio of equities and bonds over the long run, it should be, you know, it should be fine. But that ignores the behavioral aspect of investors. And it's very hard for investors over the short term to sort of, when these market events happen, to sit back and say, well, you know, I'm just going to ride it out.
Right. That's very true.
That's borne out in all sorts of studies. If you look at some of the studies, what you see is that you'll see a return for large cap stocks. And then you look at the return that the average investor in large cap stocks received. And that's much lower, sometimes 2 or 3% lower over time. And the reason for that is that investors are emotional. They buy, you know, just after the markets run up substantially, and they sell when markets are low. So it's good to take the long term, but it's the short term effects that make investors make decisions that sometimes, you know, sometimes lead to very bad impacts on the portfolio.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is it's a lot to do with the emotional side or the behavioral finance issues as opposed to the markets themselves.
Yes, it's related to it's the fact that investors are making these decisions, you know, when there are extreme swings in the market, and usually it's very disastrous for the portfolio. If you take one example, if you just look at what happened at the end of 2008, we had an extreme market correction in almost all asset classes. What investors did was they immediately went into cash or a lot more stable investments, and in 2009 was one of the biggest bull markets that occurred. And throughout that year, most people were still sitting in cash, even though the market rallied substantially. So if you could take out the ability or that emotional aspect, if you could remove it from investing, investors could have a better experience over the long run.
All right. We're talking with Khalid Begus, who works with an institutional risk management company called Milliman. But that company is now actually getting more and more available to retail investors, individuals who want to protect their portfolio. Khalid's been talking to us about market risk and liquidity risk. And one of the things he pointed out, which I have certainly seen in my 20-plus years on Wall Street, is that the investments might be okay, but the way people handle them can actually be devastating. And so even though we'll often talk to a client about being a long-term investor and the importance of that, that doesn't always help when things look so awful that people end up just selling out. So Khalid, tell us, what does it mean to hedge a portfolio? How is this actually done?
So the way we would manage the risk in a portfolio, there are two steps to that. The first thing that we would do is manage the volatility of the portfolio. Now, if we go back to something we mentioned earlier where we said we look at the long-term volatility of equities and bonds, and then you put together a portfolio for an individual investor, and maybe that investor is a moderate investor, and so you would put together a portfolio that is maybe 60% equities, 40% bonds. Well, that portfolio over the long run will have a 12% volatility. Now, if you look at 2008, though, that portfolio would have had a volatility close to 50%.
Wow.
So the moderate investor gets really scared when he sees 50% volatility. And by volatility, we mean just how much that portfolio is fluctuating on a day-to-day basis. So the first thing we do is we run a strategy to manage the risk that ensures that the volatility, the 12% volatility you're expecting for that portfolio, is not just what the portfolio achieves over a long period of time, but also over very short periods of time. So what would have happened in a 2008 scenario there would have been an overlay to manage that portfolio's volatility down to 12%. So even when the rest of the market is extremely risky, moving around quite substantially, the client looks at their portfolio and there is still movement that is equivalent to a 12% volatility. And so they would then not be less, they would be less prone to making those decisions that they would have made if their portfolio is fluctuating around a lot more.
But if so you limit the volatility to 12%, doesn't that limit it on the upside as well as the downside?
Well, the key thing is that if you look historically, what you'll see is that markets tend to go up with low volatility and they tend to go down with high volatility. And that's, you know, it's sort of behavioral as well, because investors, when markets are going up, they're not panicking, they're very calm, and so they make sort of reasoned decisions about investing. Whereas when the market's going down, there's a lot of buying and selling, there's a lot of emotion, and so there's a lot more volatility in the market as the market's declining. But to achieve your stable level of volatility over short periods of time, what you're then doing is, when volatility is low, you're over-allocating to the growth assets, the equities in this case, and when volatility is high, you're under-allocating to those. And so over time, you may see an improvement in performance by, you know, being overweight the equities in low volatility environment and underweight the equities in a high volatility environment.
So are you just looking at the difference between volatility? In other words, is that your measure, or are you looking at the height of the market? When the market goes up a lot, people go, wow, it's really high, it might go down, but that's not always true. Sometimes it keeps going up. So is the volatility the key measure here?
Well, that is one of the key measures. We look at volatility, and so as we are obviously trying to manage to a given level of volatility, the current level of volatility in the market is a key determinant of how much exposure you're going to have to the equity market. So obviously, you know, if it's not directional, it's not that we look at, well, what has the market done? Has it been running up? Okay, we're going to take some exposure off the table. That's not how it works. It's more a view of volatility and where we need to be in terms of volatility for the portfolio.
It sounds to me like in order to make these decisions, you need to have some level of prophecy, because we can always talk about how the market has been this week. It has been very volatile, or this month it has been very volatile. But how do you know what's going to happen tomorrow? Aren't you making some sort of, well, let's say prediction or prophecy, if you're on the biblical side of things?
Well, you know, that is true to some extent. But if you've done any sort of studies on volatility, and you know, I don't want to get too technical here into how the different volatility models work. A very good predictor of volatility tomorrow is actually volatility today.
Okay.
There are various measures of volatility in various different models you could use, but you can, in most instances, come very close to the volatility for tomorrow by looking at the volatility of today, with some different measure of how you weight your observations in the past for calculating that volatility.
Okay, but, I just want to differentiate. I believe you're not saying that past performance is an indication of future returns in terms of the stock market, meaning if the market went up yesterday, it doesn't mean it's going up today. But you're saying that if there was volatility previously, then we can assume that may continue to some, you know, within some parameters.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Wow. There's a lot going on, and in fact, I have many, many questions. But unfortunately, we're nearing the end of our time. But let me just leave with one more question. When people try to hedge their portfolio, doesn't that end up cutting off their upside? Because if you're out of the market and then it shoots up, you know, you've missed it.
Well, that is true if you compare your portfolio to a naked portfolio. So, for example, if you look at large cap stocks hedged and just pure large cap stocks, there is some give up on the upside. But the way we look at it is not to compare it against large cap stocks. If you want risk management for your portfolio, you would never have been 100% invested in large cap stocks. You may have been invested 60% large cap, 40% bonds. So the true comparison is against an alternative that you would have invested in. If you were 100% in large cap stocks naked, then you don't need risk management if you are that type of a risk taker. But for people who want risk management in their portfolio, the true comparison is, how does my equities with hedging or with some risk management overlay compared to my alternative, which is a 60-40 mm-hmm. or 50-50, depending on your risk profile? So that is what we view as the true comparison for a hedged portfolio.
Okay. I think that sounds to me like an intelligent way to look at it. You have to compare, as it were, apples to apples, or at least what you would otherwise be doing if you weren't involved in a hedged portfolio. Khalid, this has been fascinating. We're unfortunately out of time. Tell me, in the last few seconds, how can people learn more about you and the work that you're doing?
Well, they can go to our website, milliman.com/FRM for financial risk management. And we have a lot more information on the work that we do in the different capacities, white papers that we've written, research that we've done on that website.
Okay, so we will put a link to that at the show notes of GoldsteinOnGelt.com. Khalid, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug.
Earlier on in the show, I spoke to you about buying bonds as a way of getting income. There's a strategy that people use. We use it all the time when we help clients build bond portfolios. It's called a bond ladder. We always encourage people to diversify their portfolio, whether that's buying different asset classes, meaning stocks, bonds, real estate, different types of investments, but also inside those assets, you can diversify different sectors, different parts of the economy, different size companies. And with bonds, there's something else you can do, which is you can diversify the time. Because when you buy a bond, let's say you buy a 3-year bond, well, there's also 6-year bonds and 2-year bonds and 30-year bonds. How can you diversify that way? And the answer is you can create a bond ladder. There's a little more to the strategy, and I've got a free video that I'd like to encourage you to check out. Go to my corporate website. It's profile-financial.com/videos. Again, that's www.profile-financial.com/videos. And you'll see there's a two-part video that I created called Learn How to Make a Bond Ladder, Part 1 and Part 2. Hey, thinking of Part 2, stay tuned for Part 2 of the Goldstein on Gelt show. I'm your host, Doug Goldstein. I'll be bringing on Chris Cogswell, a money manager who deals in a very, very specialized area of the market that it turns out lots and lots of people are interested in.
You're listening to Money Maven Doug Goldstein on the Goldstein on Gelt show. Stay tuned for the second half of the show right after the break.